We're back from summer break with another episode of Dan Has a Plan Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm Daniel B. Smith, a certified financial planner on the Family Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. Our branch is located in Paramus, New Jersey, and I can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest today is Pete Brown. Pete is a veteran in the IT industry and has a side passion metal band called Hath, H-A-T-H, and we're looking forward to speaking to him today. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and his views are his own.
We got a guy with a band on today.
Exactly.
We love that he has a career in IT, but we're here to talk about the band.
Yeah, this is going to feather into financial planning a little bit because it has all the components of what you need to do to start a business.
Yeah, I think everybody's going to love this episode. We do have an Ask Dan question today.
Here we go.
People have a lot of questions for Dan.
We're here.
Dan's here for all your questions. And while we're here, just a reminder that if you do have a question for Dan, you can email me at Alana, A-L-A-N-N-A dot Smith, S-M-I-T-H, at UBS.com. Send me your questions and we will feature it on an episode. This question is different than what Pete's experience is, so we'll get both sides of this, but it does have to do with starting a band. So this listener writes in, says, "Hi, Dan. My husband's band makes a little money from gigs, but between guitars, amps, studio time, and travel, they probably spend more than they make. So the question every hobbyist musician's wife wants to ask, can we write any of this off on our taxes?"
That's definitely a CPA question, but it falls on the fault line of hobby versus business.
Yeah.
And I have to defer this question to a CPA. All right.
Right. We're not tax experts, but we're here to help and guide.
Yeah. Obviously, I cannot give tax and or legal advice.
And also, I'm not an expert in any of it, just to clarify.
What I would say is this, I can talk about discretionary income or discretionary spending. And here's how I would view it. So let's just say a couple goes out to dinner three times a month and spends $1,000. That's $12,000 a year. I'd be willing to guess that this man is spending about $12,000 a year on his passion.
Sure.
If it makes him happy, I wouldn't look so much for the tax write-off as I would for the happiness quotient.
So you're saying put it in the plan.
Put it in the plan. Don't worry so much about how much it is because it sounds like it's manageable. I would lean towards the pie chart of having an emergency fund. Are you funding your Roth IRA, your company 401k? Do you have good health? Are you pursuing some things that make you happy? And I'm sure this person asking the question has something that she's passionate about. So I look at it more from a happiness quotient because happy partnerships, basically longevity. Being happy is part of that.
Right.
So it was a good question, one I have to defer to the CPA. But bottom line is, I think you should always have a passion. If it's a healthy passion, I'm very supportive of it in a financial plan.
Right. And who knows, maybe the band will take off. It'll start to make some more money.
There's always that hope.
Yeah. We're sending you lots of support for your passions and write us about yours. We want to hear about that.
Yeah. Love the questions.
Yeah.
So Alana J, let's meet the Pete Brown.
Here we go.
J. Smith, we're joined by the Pete Brown.
Yeah, we got a rocker in the studio today.
That's right.
Thank you for having me.
How old are you, first of all?
I'm 38.
What a great age that is.
A spry 38.
So when you look back on your life, when was your first spark of interest about music?
Probably third grade. I feel like this is a very standard elementary school experience. They start everyone on the recorder and you're playing
Hot Cross Buns.
Mary Had a Little Lamb. And everyone just had to do that. But in my school, they would bring older students from the school band in and just demonstrate the different instruments to encourage and motivate kids to sign up for the band. There were demonstrations of clarinet and drums and trumpets and French horn. I remember watching the clarinet and thinking, oh, that's just a bigger version of what I'm already doing and I'm pretty good at this, so I'm just going to keep doing that.
Logic.
And I don't have to go to class for an hour 2 days a week.
Nice.
Right.
So that started it. And I kept doing it all through grammar school, middle school, and then into high school, dropped the clarinet completely and picked up a guitar.
it's cooler to play a guitar.
Oh, it's so much cooler. My high school didn't have a formal band. We didn't have a marching band. We had a small jazz band. Ooh. And had this jazz band audition. And it was more or less show up, tinker around a little bit, and you were in the jazz band. I didn't know anything about jazz. I was like, I'm good at the clarinet. Someone told me there are clarinets and jazz bands. I'll show up. And everyone there had either a guitar, a bass, drums, and they had no clue what to do with me.
That is so good.
What were you listening to in high school?
Growing up, it was a lot of whatever my parents were listening to, and that was classic rock on the radio, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, Creedence Clearwater Revival, just whatever was in rotation. But I think the first band, I would say it was like my band, that I found I got really into, as cliche as it probably sounds, was Metallica. Metal guy in a metal band, you start with Metallica. But that was like the first band I remember really sinking my teeth into and just obsessively devouring albums, and before YouTube, when I could get music videos or see a recording of a live performance, just obsessive about it.
Yeah, you went all in.
My introduction to Metallica was Mariano Rivera entering the game.
His walkout song?
His walkout song. Huh. I had never even heard of Metallica.
What was the song?
Sandman.
Oh, perfect. Mm-hmm.
So you're in high school, you're digging the guitar. How do things evolve?
My mom had an old acoustic guitar just sitting in my grandparents' attic or something like that. I was, I don't know, 13 or 14 and just nonstop. I want to learn how to play guitar. I want a guitar. I want to learn how to play. The next town over was a little mom and pop music studio, Woodside Music.
Shout out Woodside Music.
My mom gave me this very, very old, I think it was a Hondo acoustic guitar from the 1960s, terribly set up. Strings were probably an inch and a half sitting off the fretboard. She said, we'll get you a little music book. If you can teach yourself for a few months and you stick with it, we'll talk about guitar lessons.
Wow. Nice.
Okay. I was a 14-year-old left to my devices with a guitar and just nonstop all day making noise to the point where they were trying to go to bed. I was still just hammering on this insanely out of tune guitar. I wore them down.
All right. We'll take you.
Yeah.
I love it.
I think it was like a birthday present one year. It's like, all right, we'll get you guitar lessons. So we went up to the music studio. We got on the schedule and they had a handful of different teachers there. I remember they asked, what kind of music does he like? What kind of music does he want to learn? Does he know? And I just said, I want to play metal. 100% bought in on Metallica at that point. I was like, I want to learn that. And with my acoustic guitar. Yeah.
I just got it.
There you go.
And luckily, there was a teacher there, Terry Sirik, who was the metal guitar teacher, but I came to learn over years of lessons and becoming friends with him. He's got a much bigger career before that. He had been on a ton of different recordings. He had played with and recorded, I think, with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Wow.
So he had a resume. He knew what he was doing.
Super.
And again, once lessons started, I want lessons nonstop became I want an electric guitar nonstop. And same sort of deal. Learn how to play it on acoustic and then we'll figure it out. And I think after a year, my parents bought me my first electric guitar and everything in the house got a lot louder.
Yep. The amp came into play.
Yep. They did buy me headphones at one point to plug into the amp. So they didn't have to listen to me as much.
That's good.
But it just snowballed from there. I took lessons all through high school at Woodside. I worked at Woodside for 4 years working behind the desk, started just doing scheduling, picking up the phone and doing sales, graduated and was taught how to set up and work on guitars. So that really started getting the gears going. If it was slow, my job was take guitars off the wall, clean them up, tune them, change strings. And if no one's here, you can play them a little bit. So I was there 3 nights a week, every week.
So are we thinking we're going to go make this commercial and get a band together? What was your mindset?
Oh, that was absolutely the intention.
Yeah.
For me, nice. Not my parents.
First of all, I like mom with the goal setting.
Yeah.
Okay. So she definitely dangled the carrot to make sure that you were committed to the process. Love it.
Yeah, I don't know if it ever went one way or the other way where it was, okay, we'll make a deal and he'll fall out of it.
Yeah.
Or if it was like, no, we're going to establish goals and routines and make him work for it. But paid off to my advantage.
You got there.
Working at the music studio, I was around music teachers all day. I think pretty much all of them went to some sort of formal college or conservatory for music. A lot of Berkeley, some, I think, NYU, some went to Juilliard, and just kind of getting exposure and asking them questions like, what was school like? And learning about there's an audition process and you have to prepare for that. And depending on the school, and this is 2005, 2006, programs at that time, I remember, were fairly limited. At least with Berkeley, if you were going for guitar, it was like you went for jazz guitar or you went for classical guitar. Mm. And there were other avenues like composition, orchestration, but I was like narrow focused. I want to play guitar. And a lot of the teachers who had done that, they teach on some days, they gig at night. A lot of them were living in the city, playing at jazz clubs or blues clubs after teaching all day. So hearing about that, getting there, recommendations on, I didn't know anything about jazz or blues. So having them just expose me to jazz players or old blues players, what are these standards? What are they playing every night when improvising over and this, that, and the other thing? I learned I hate jazz. It was always like, what if I want to play metal? And what if I want to play rock? And all of them said, don't go to college for it. If you're going to go to college, get a degree in something you can use, go to classes and work towards that, and also be in a band. You do not need to go to music school to be in a rock band.
I'm thinking that's good advice.
It's probably the best advice I got out of that studio.
And also, well, like, there wasn't an avenue for you. You're not going to go play classical guitar if you don't want to. Like, mm-hmm. It would have been a waste of your time and money.
At that time, too, there was still a lot of ownership in terms of if you want to get into recording, if you mm-hmm. want to learn about the technology side, if you want to work in studios, you could go to school for that. You could go to Berkeley. They had classes and programs around that. I didn't know anything about it. And the resources that are available now and how easy it is to do it now, none of that existed. So right. It was still very much like an older mindset of you have to invest in it in a big way. And that's what you're going to do. You can't really try it out.
Were you thinking the heck with college? I'm just going to go rock.
That was the hope. My parents wouldn't let me.
So were these sit down real conversations? You know, did they spend an hour pros and cons and all that stuff?
I don't remember if we did pro and con conversations. If we didn't do exactly that, there were conversations like it. And we went and visited Rutgers. I'd never been there, didn't know anything about the school. On the way home, I told them, I'm going to go there. I applied, was accepted, went in undeclared. I think that was one of the big reasons I picked Rutgers, because it had kind of everything. If I wanted to change my major every year, I could do that. And that's where the bands started.
When did you meet your first band to get that together?
There were two radio stations on the campus. I think it was just word of mouth. Someone told a DJ there, oh, there's this 18-year-old who plays guitar. Very small metal community at Rutgers at that time. Another guy had just mentioned he was putting a band together. He was trying to find a guitarist, and the DJ name dropped me. So this guy reached out to me and said, hey, would you be interested? Freshman year, I don't know anything. I don't know anybody. He's like, yeah, I live off campus on the street. Come over. We'll jam and start working on stuff. Grab my guitar, hop on a bus, go across campus, knock on a door. I'm just a scared little 18-year-old. I meet this guy. So we start talking about bands, and that was the start of it. We hit it off pretty well. That first band, the two of us were kind of like the main creative backbone for 7-8 years. That was my first band. That was his, I think, second band. So we didn't know anything about how any of this stuff worked. How to book shows, how to play shows, how to find and work with other people. And that just started the process of figuring it out.
Just diving right in.
We had no money doing this. And technology side of recording and gear wasn't there yet. So when it was time to record something, it was a serious investment. One time we went to a studio in Long Island City, and it was $350 per day. And a day was, I think, 6 to 8 hours, depending on how long the engineer wanted to hang out. So we have no money. We're working for under 10 bucks an hour, part-time jobs.
Yeah.
So that was all of our money, four people together doing this. And it was a terrible recording.
So did the band have a name right at the beginning?
Yeah, the band's name was Dystrophy. We played out a bunch. We made friends with someone who had a t-shirt printing company. So had some friends who were in the Rutgers Art School and they were getting into digital design. So they started teaching us designing things like logos and t-shirt designs. And that's how this whole puzzle started coming together of like, oh, it's not just going out and playing music. There's a whole merchandising and showmanship side to it beyond just, oh, I'm good at guitar.
How do you even book your first gig? That had to be like daunting, right?
Yeah, terrifying. A lot of cold calling bars. If you had friends in bands who were already playing out, bugging them like, hey, can we get an opening spot on your show? Can you introduce us to whoever the promoter is, the booking agent? We were very lucky that New Brunswick historically has a very active punk and hardcore scene and a very active basement show scene. This is going back into like the 80s where students rent houses for the purpose of throwing shows in their basement.
Yes. Wild. Isn't that awesome, Dad?
This is wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. And touring bands, especially college age and just after college age, make New Brunswick a stop on their East Coast routes because they're such an active scene. They know people will show up.
Nice.
That's awesome.
The cover is supposed to be going to the touring band. All the bands sell shirts or CDs or whatever you got. Whoever's hosting is supposed to put the touring band up. You just give them dinner, put them up for the night, and then they move on. And
that's, tremendous.
It's like a whole flywheel of those bands leave, they tell their friends, then their friends come to New Brunswick. So there was this really active scene happening. There are these punk and hardcore shows that are not really what we play at all. And I think someone felt bad for us and we're like, all right, we'll put you on. We started learning how that worked. And then we made friends with people who wanted to have show houses. So we worked with them to throw shows. And now there are metal shows happening in New Brunswick.
Wow.
And then more metal bands are now popping up. So because our friends want to be in bands or we're making bands with them, and it all just started bubbling up.
Were you looking at the music industry as a viable option?
We definitely wanted to try and make an official go of it. I remember we were putting together press kits. We were trying to make ourselves sound better than we actually were on the resume. We were mailing these manila envelopes out to record labels or emailing them. Whenever we would have a new demo posted, we were just cold emailing websites and just trying for anything to happen. We also kind of had in the back of our head the entire time, you're probably never gonna pay your bills in a metal band. Once we all started graduating and started getting real jobs, I think reality started setting in.
Yeah. So did you have fans?
Yeah, we had fans. We had a few little write-ups. At that time, MySpace was like the big deal.
Yes. Awesome.
So we had people who were following us on MySpace, sharing our stuff around, but it was a lot more fun.
Yeah.
A lot more fun to try and network and be in a band.
So when did traditional employment cross with the band?
You can say real job. That band never paid me.
Okay. All right. What field did you pursue?
So coming out of college, I had a communication degree, which I like to say I had a degree in going to college. Still,
it's pretty broad.
Yeah. I wanted to do things in the music industry, entertainment industry. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't really have any kind of big exposure into like, how does the real world work? My only internship in college was one summer. I worked at a metal PR agency out of a woman's house in Freehold, New Jersey.
That's awesome. Wow. How many bands did she handle?
Oh, she handled legitimately big bands.
Wow.
In the 80s, New Jersey was a big center of the heavy metal scene that was popping up at that time.
No way.
So California is like where these bands started. And then a lot of them moved to New Jersey for a little bit, just a little period of time before they really blew up. Metallica being one of them.
Wow.
Then you had all these New York metal and hardcore bands popping up at the same time. And this woman, Maria Ferraro, was in the center of all of it as it was happening. And she built her business around that. Go in for an interview, walk into her basement, and there are gold and platinum records all over the wall. Because she was the marketing and the promotion and the PR for all these huge bands.
So that was maybe an avenue you saw.
Yeah. Made friends there that after college, I was like, how do I do this? Can I come back to this PR agency? And they were like, no, like, it's not you. There's just not enough work, not enough bands. There's too many people. It's a very much like a contractor freelancing kind of world. So I got a normal job. I was a marketing assistant at a little agency. That agency was acquired a few times. It turned into an email marketing agency that kind of got me into marketing technology and web development. At that time bands are kind of coming and going and the focus is like, okay, I'm an adult now. I have to pay rent. I have to buy food. Now, fast forward to 2015, got a remote job. And that's where this core group of friends that is now this band that I'm in, that's where we really all synced up. Before I came back, three of the guys in the band had already done one recording, released it. They wanted to make it a real band. They wanted to play shows and they tell me right away, hey, we need a fourth person. You want in? I said, yes, absolutely. When can we start? They're like, actually, so that's a funny thing. We just signed a record contract. We're recording a full length album right now. You need to drop in on this.
Like, whoa. So what was the breakdown of instruments and vocal? Like, how is it set up?
The three other guys, Frank, Greg, and AJ. Frank was the singer and primary guitarist. Greg was a singer, bassist, and also plays guitar. So he was contributing before I joined. AJ is the drummer, production engineer. He was learning all the studio side things all at the same time. And all of our bands were his opportunity to experiment and learn how all this works. They said, here are all the songs. Most of the guitar tracks are done, but we need you to write solos for all these songs.
Wow.
Go for it.
So you were working a remote job, you said,
yeah,
at the time? That probably afforded you a little bit of flexibility.
Yes.
There?
Nice. Yep. Any downtime I had at home, the guitar was next to me at all times. I'm learning the songs. I'm just drilling it. We signed this record deal, 2-album deal. We think, okay, we're in. This is a label, Willow Tip Records. They've been around for decades. They've put out a lot of albums that we love from bands that we love.
So that's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, we're just a bunch of metal dorks. And we think, oh, because we love these albums and they put out these albums, they must be huge. This must be a full production house. We're in. No, that's not how any of it works.
But also, I don't think there's any one way anymore. There's no standard, especially I think in the music industry. You can speak to this more, but there's just been so much change in the last 20 years.
And none of this is talking down on Willow Tip or anyone involved. This is more of a credit to them doing this 10, 15 years before everybody else. Willow Tip Records primarily is a 4-person team running a global distribution record label out of a house. They sign bands that they love. They give them some amount of resources to make an album, make music videos. They help them with printing merch, and then they put it out there. They coordinate the marketing, and you guys work together on selling your album. But they will only work as hard as you work. Where like a major label, you know, something huge, a Universal, a Sony, they've got teams. They've got it just dialed in, run books of exactly how this is going to run. We know months ahead of time what the schedules are and who's doing what and what's premiering where. And you've got interviews lined up. None of that. Right. This is very DIY.
The idea is that you make money and they get a cut of it later.
Yeah. Whatever money they put up, this is like very traditional record label. Whatever money they put up has to get paid back first. And then the cuts go back and forth.
Okay.
We don't know anything about this.
Yeah. You're just excited to make the record.
Right. We think, oh, they gave us a budget. It was a few $1,000s, which is insane to us. Like, yeah, we've never had that much money to play with to play music. I think the most we'd ever gotten paid at a show up to that point was like $100 and a few beers.
Yeah. So where's that money going?
We were pretty conscious from the beginning. It's nice to have money in budget. We don't want to spend all of it because we have no idea how much money this record's going to make. And we didn't want to fall into a trap of owing someone $10,000 or something like that. Hey. We knew people just from being in the scene who had gotten big deals and an album didn't do so well. And now they're kind of stuck until something gets paid back. So we were a little afraid of that. Again, very DIY. We found an artist we really liked. We bought a piece of art from him that became our album art. I was handy with Photoshop, talking with the record label. I asked, do you have design files for how CD jackets and vinyl and all this is supposed to lay out? He's like, yeah, here are templates, go nuts. So I had to teach myself how to do layout design for all that. We used some of that money to upgrade AJ's studio so it would sound better. We paid for someone to master the album.
Nice.
Very calculated investments. Not really a budget in mind, but we wanted to make sure we didn't end up spending thousands that we were never going to be able to payback.
So is this a small company you organized with 4 partners?
Funny enough, yeah. Shortly after that, yeah, we created a company. We were like, oh, wait, we can write a lot of this off for taxes.
You know, when I think of like starting a business, there's the legal side of it. Did you have an attorney?
before we signed the contract, I wasn't involved in this part, but they did consult with an entertainment lawyer just to make sure there weren't any sort of loopholes or gotchas in this contract. And this was a very basic, straightforward contract. It was like, you give me two albums, we put them out, here's the cut.
So we touched on the second piece, which is the accounting end of it. And then there's things like copyright. How do you get that piece going?
So that's where the benefit of working with a label really stands out.
So Willowtip had that expertise?
Yes, they had that expertise on the copyright side, the distribution side, especially now. This is 2018 when the first full length came out. So streaming is already full force. No one's buying CDs anymore. Now that's getting into distribution on streaming platforms, licensing and royalty payments from streaming platforms. You're dealing with people re-uploading your music on websites, and piracy is still happening. So right. Takedown requests and counterfeiting, all of that, they have agreements with different parties because they do just so much business that they're able to build these relationships and offer that as a service to the artists they work with.
So you're creating the music, and then there's the end user who's enjoying the music and they're compensating you to enjoy it. And that has to filter all the way back to your bank account somehow.
Somehow.
Okay.
And that's where touring and live performance comes in a little bit, right?
Yes.
People feel pressure to tour where they might not have before because streaming isn't making people money.
Almost nothing. A single stream of a song, depending on your agreement, what level you're at, is fractions of a penny.
Isn't that crazy?
I'm getting a little depressed on that.
I know.
This number might be a little outdated. At one time, I remember looking up, like, how much is a million streams on Spotify worth? Because a million, big number, big, nice number. At that time, it was about $2,000.
I know, it hurts.
And then I'm looking at the liability side, things like, did you have to get insurance? Because I'm thinking, like, someone's at your concert and they do a mosh pit and someone gets hurt. Like, what happens?
That's a good question. So we had more than a few of those, like, learning moments where we think, oh, label takes care of this. And we would ask Willowtip a question along those lines. And they were like, no, that's on you. It's like, oh, that's where it starts hitting home. Like, no, we're a business now. We have to figure these things out. We've had instances where something walks off at a show, something disappears, something just breaks. You're on the road so much, something gets rattled in a trailer or a van and just breaks the wrong way. At least the insurance is there to cover it.
Yeah. And I'm even thinking of, like, the merchandising. If you're in different states, there's sales tax in different states. How do you keep that all straight? Like,
do you have a business manager?
Yeah.
Or is it you?
It's us.
It's you. Yeah.
So if you sell $3,000 worth of t-shirts at a show, you've got to pay the state of Virginia, say if you're playing there, sales tax. And it's probably like a cash thing.
A lot of cash. 10 years ago, it was all cash. Technology has gotten just so easy and it's everywhere. Things like Square, Stripe, people tapping their phones. I have an app on my phone where someone could just tap their phone if they want to buy a shirt, and that's the transaction. So going back to, like, your salesman from the first band, figuring this all out, one of the best things we can do at a concert, we have found, is just be present at it. It's really nice if you can afford and you have the room and people willing to be a merch person for you. Some of the best interactions we've had have been at the merch table, where before the show, someone comes up, they maybe have never heard us. They're looking at t-shirt designs. They're seeing what's on the table. We sell CDs and vinyl and pins and hats. And I joke, but it's really not a joke. We are a merchandise and a clothing company that advertises with music.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And that's what, at least for extreme music, like the kind of metal I play, that's how it works. You don't make your money from shows until you hit a certain level. You make your money from the merch sales.
One thing we didn't focus on was the physicality of your music. Do you have to be in shape to play for an hour?
Yeah.
I know I perspire very easily. I'm sensing it's kind of like playing a high school basketball game for 32 minutes and, like, you're burned after an hour. Yep. Or whatever the time frame is.
I will readily admit I'm disgusting when I get off stage.
Yeah. That's how you know you did it right.
Exactly. And some of these venues, we've played very big venues. We've played very small venues. We've played venues in the middle of winter, so it's freezing in the room. We've played pretty much warehouses when it's 100 degrees outside and there's no HVAC system. I'm gross every time I get off stage because I'm not a singer. Frank and Greg, who are singing, they can take breaks while they're singing, but they're not moving around. Our Our drummer AJ is moving four limbs constantly for 30 to 60 minutes straight. And then it's my job, on top of playing guitar, to do crowd interaction. I have to move around. I have to be going around stage. I have to be like making faces, pointing at people, trying to get people to move, because no one goes to a show just to watch four guys stand on stage and play a song. They want an experience. They want a show.
When you go to plan a tour, what does that look like?
We are fortunate enough to have people who want to work with us, booking agents. Before that, we all have to figure out how we can coordinate paid time off from work in order to do this.
Love that.
We're lucky enough where we can work with promoters and booking agents who have those relationships with clubs. They'll start putting feelers out months ahead of time based on the feedback they get. They'll start building a route. We'll tell them, hey, we haven't gone to the Northeast for a while. We want to go up there, or we want to do Florida out to Texas and back, or we want to do full US. A promoter might hit us up. Hey, I've got a band coming over or playing a tour. They're looking for an opener. This is your rate. This is the route we have so far. Expect 30 days, full US and Canada. That's sometimes all you have to start. You have to buy in pretty quickly because you're not the only one they're talking to. That's not the only promoter who was told about this. Mm. And so they might be soliciting opening spots, and then the touring band, the headliners, will pick who they want. So that's step one. You got the tour. You know when you're going out. So we know the gear we need to bring. We know from experience what we need to make every night just to break even on something like this, between the cost of renting a van and a trailer, gas, some food. If we're renting an Airbnb or a hotel, that all gets baked in. If we're sleeping in the van, how many nights in a row are we doing that?
Wow.
So we start building a budget out of that. And then we start building a merch inventory. We know we sell large and extra large t-shirts the most. We know sweatshirts take up the most room. We know we don't sell any smalls, so bring three. Okay. Then you have your table item. What's your inventory at the studio? Do you have to go order more? What's the lead time on that? So there's all these things working at the same time that you have to figure out before you ever play a note.
A lot of decisions.
And event planning.
Yeah. A lot of logistics.
Is sponsorship anything that's ever been explored?
We've worked with a few different companies. At least at our level, it's a lot of, we'll send you some free strings or drumsticks. Give us a shout out. Throw some posts online, tag us in it, we'll repost it. So it's very reciprocal and very low cost. We're not at the level of, hey, I want a free guitar or anything like that. I don't want more guitars. I like my guitars. But where that comes in really handy is if something breaks on the road and it's like, hey, we ran out of strings and we have a very specific type that we like and we use. All of our guitars are set up a certain way to use this type of string. Can you help us out?
Right.
We're going to be in Las Vegas next week. All right, we'll ship it to the club. Jeez. So it's not so much, oh, I got a free toy or I'm getting paid from this kind of stuff. It's more like when something goes wrong, someone's backing me up.
So when I look at your life, Pete, as a planner, there's what I call the reliable piece and what I call the variable piece. So I talk to clients a lot about this, and the passion has cash flow that comes from the stable area of your life. Or are they just, are they church and state? The money over here is what I make and I use that, and the money and the band and its prospects have to kind of sustain itself.
More the latter. For the last few years, we have not paid any of our own money into the band.
Bravo.
Yes.
Bravo.
That's really magnificent.
Okay. So for things like, I want a new guitar, I want a new amp, something like that, we will typically buy that for ourselves, specifically because now the band is a business. Anything that is bought by the business is owned by the business.
Right.
Taxes and depreciations and all that, that we just don't want to deal with.
Sure.
Him whipping up depreciation.
Yeah. We've had a lot of conversations about trying to figure out how to do this the right way or the wrong way. We're also fortunate enough to be at a point where the band does sustain itself.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. We
big accomplishment.
Thanks. We're at a point now where it's when we need to raise money for something, we have enough little tricks to make things work. We have enough connections. We'll have a tour coming up, or we just have a box of old t-shirts that we're like, oh, I thought we got rid of these. We don't want to keep them. We just want to get rid of them. All right, let's book a show. We'll headline, we'll do second support, something like that. And we're going to tell all the bands we're playing with, hey, we're doing this to get rid of old stock. So we're selling things cheaper than normal. Usually the other bands are on board. They're like, okay, yeah, let's do that.
Nice.
And everyone just starts moving merch.
A flash sale. Nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's
right. this has been the best conversation. Learning so much. I'm learning so much.
Yeah. But we have things like that where it's like, we need to make a little bit of money in order to invest back in the band. How do we do that? Does that turn into a sale on our online stores? Does it mean we're going to print a new design or offer something new? We want to go into the studio or upgrade something for AJ's studio. How do we start thinking about making money in that way that we're not paying for it out of pocket?
You told me the name of your first band. What's the name of this band?
This band I'm in, for anyone who wants to check it out, if you like metal, look us up. Our name is Hath, H-A-T-H. We're on every streaming site, Spotify, Apple, Prime, YouTube. We're there.
Amazing.
Please look us up.
And if you're listening to Dan Has a Plan on Spotify, this is an easy move. Just go look up Hath.
I always ask every guest this question. So what aha moment did you experience where the euphoria was so high that it just was the best moment or gig, or it could be like a fan talking to you?
So almost 2 years ago now, October 2024, we played a festival in New York. It was the Metal Injection Festival, semi-annual show, but it pops up around the country. There's a network of music publications that get together, and they'll have three stages at clubs in a city, and it's an all-weekend event. We got invited to play. We show up, we're lower on the card, and there's a ton of bands that we've looked up to since we were kids playing this show.
Nice.
And so there are just people walking through the room. I'm like, that's deer in headlights walking past some of these people. We've been doing this for 20 years and we're still getting starstruck and we're shy. So we play our set, and we played an outdoor stage. It was unbelievably hot. I had the sun in my face the entire time. I couldn't see anything beyond the second row of people in front of me. It was just blinded. It was also the first show I had played with this new floorboard amp unit setup that I had made. So I'm fried. It's a big show. There's a lot going on. My nerves are going. And after our set, we're like loading out, and one of our friends in another band that's there comes up to me and he says, "Did you realize that Luke LeMay, who is a very famous and respected, well-known name, did you know Luke LeMay was staring at you the entire time? He was standing right in front of you, watching you play." I went, "No, I couldn't see anything." "Was he?" He's like, "Yeah, he was watching you the entire time." I was like, "Oh my God, I missed it. Ah." I'm like, "All right, maybe I can catch him. There's an artist bar area, or just walking around. Maybe he's somewhere there." So we're taking all of our gear into the back rooms where you store everything. Coming down from just played a show, adrenaline's still kind of going. It's 100 degrees in this club. I walk over to this artist bar where they have kind of a roped off section for the musicians. And I walk in there and Luke is standing right there, and he snaps and he points at me and he goes, "You, I want to talk to you." He's from Quebec. So it's a very thick French accent, Quebec accent. "I want to talk to you. That amp on your floorboard, I want to talk to you about that. Do you like it?" We just start talking for maybe 20 minutes about the most nerdy gear conversation, just a little minutia. He's telling me what his setup is and why he likes it. The aha was this guy who's been a name since the 80s is now grilling me about gear because he wants to know about it. He liked what he heard. He liked what he saw. He's, "I want to know more about this. Let's talk. Let's talk."
You're a peer.
Yeah. That's exactly. Awesome. It was like, oh, we're all just giant music nerds.
And honestly, if you had seen him watch you, you would have lost your mind.
Oh, I probably would have freaked out.
Yeah, it's better it happened this way.
Yeah,
that's a deserving moment, Pete. So Alana J. Smith, this is the Pete Brown.
Thank you, Pete. This has been awesome.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Alana J., that was the Pete Brown.
Rock on.
Exactly. Who knew all the intricacies and work it is just to get on stage?
Yeah. I mean, the big takeaway for me is that, like, if you're going to do it, have the band sustain itself. It takes a lot of organization and work. You ever been asked to be in a band?
I've never been asked to be in a band, but I was in the band in high school. Like he mentioned in the episode, he started off on the recorder. My mother introduced me to piano lessons. The purpose of the piano lesson was to learn how to read music. So I do have the ability to read music. music.
Which is, honestly, it's a lost art. People aren't reading music anymore.
Well, all cars eat gas and every good boy does fine. Those are acronyms that I'm sure people have taken piano know.
Yes, or some version.
Let's just say I had a weak left hand.
Okay. Well.
Polly Jenkins did her best.
Shout out Polly Jenkins.
So the tie-in I have with Pete is I was at church one day, probably eight or nine. I grew up in the Mohawk Valley, and this singing band that was practicing at the church had a trumpet player that I was mesmerized by.
Yeah.
It was, I think they were called the Mohegans, Mohawk Valley Mohegans, Native American culture. Bottom line, I fell in love with the trumpet right then and there. So I got my first trumpet, a Bundy. Apparently, it wasn't the highest level piece of tin that music lovers will probably identify with. But
it did the trick.
It did. It did. And I played religiously to my junior year in high school. And I was very self-conscious of this because I didn't like marching in the band.
Well, weren't you also playing football?
Yeah, but I did a couple no-shows with certain events that, you know,
the parents
didn't know about. I finally wrote a note and put it in the refrigerator for my parents to read because I know they would both see it then.
That's such a good move.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a heartfelt letter. It just said, I'm walking away from the trumpet. Now, the real reason I walked away was because of the band.
Why, you were embarrassed?
I was, yeah.
This is why we need more exposure, because it's cool to be in the band.
Exactly. I see that now. It's one of my biggest faux pas that I walked away. But thanks to Pete, I can live vicariously through people pushing through. You know, he started off with a crazy junk guitar, then went to acoustic and practiced and practiced and practiced. And it wasn't until he got to college that stars kind of lined up for him.
Regardless of how long you stick with it, you always have an appreciation that stays with you.
This is how it comes full circle. Your mom and I went to West Point. They have a concert every Sunday night, and this particular concert was to be outside, but they had to move it inside because of the rain. And a trumpet player came up to the stage, soloist, and played Danny Boy on the trumpet.
Your favorite.
Weepy.
Oh.
Weepy. And he was hitting notes that I didn't know were even possible on the trumpet.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I gotta tell you, I'll never ever forget that. I can hear it in my ears right now. It was awesome.
What a fantastic instrument. Just cut straight to the core.
Yeah, exactly.
Shout out to all the music lovers out there. Keep rocking on.
The Peter Brown.
Till next time.
Love you.
Presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.